know, the real Bonhoeffer had a much more kind of ambivalent attitude toward this question of whether violence is ever justified, even in response to a tyrannical regime. He ultimately comes to the conclusion around 1942, 1943, that actually there isn't, Ten Commandments, there's actually not a Christian justification, even for the murder of the tyrant. But he feels compelled by his conscience to take that action anyway, and therefore needs to simply beg, fall on God's grace and forgiveness and beg for mercy because of this impossible dilemma.
Welcome to the Upwards podcast, where we discuss the intersection of Christian faith in the academy, church, and marketplace to illuminate the good work happening with individuals, institutions, and our communities. I'm one of your hosts, Dan, and I'm excited to introduce an episode with Brandon Block, a professor of history at UW-Madison, and his new book, Reinventing Protestant Germany, which covers Germany from World War I up until the 1960s, looking particularly at religion in Germany, looking at figures like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the role people like Bonhoeffer played in how Germans and Americans and others thought about German Christianity, and also looking at topics like secularism or secularization and how the German example can help us see those trends with fresh eyes. Please enjoy the conversation. Welcome to the Upwards podcast. I'm here with Brandon Block. Hey, Brandon.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to sit down with you, have a talk about your new book. It came out this summer with Harvard University Press, called Reinventing Protestant Germany, Religious Nationalists and the Contest for Post-Nazi Democracy. So, Brandon, before getting into the book, just give us a brief intro, including, you know, what you do at the UW and what you teach.
Sure. So I'm an assistant professor in the history department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I've been here since August of 2020, so came right in the middle of the pandemic. By training, I'm a historian of modern Germany, German-speaking Europe. So I teach courses on Europe since 1815, pretty broad, and then more specialized courses on modern German history, the Weimar Republic, as well as a capstone seminar on genocide, war crimes, trials, and human rights. And the sort of human rights angle on German history is especially something that I pursue in my research as well.
So we're in the middle of a semester. What are you teaching right now this semester?
So currently I'm teaching a writing intensive class called The Weimar Republic and the Rise of Nazism. So the aim is to think about the Weimar Republic not as a state that was doomed to fail from the outset. This is the democracy that gets created in Germany in 1919 following Germany's defeat at World War I. The democracy ultimately collapses in 1933 with the appointment of Hitler as chancellor. But what I try to point out to the students is this isn't simply a linear story of decline, but there were also many movements for reform in the areas of urban planning, in the arts and sexuality, a new opportunities for democracy. So we try to look at this as a kind of complex period where we can see both a democratizing society, but also a society that's producing deep reactionary currents that ultimately lead to the Nazi Party's takeover in 1933. And then I'm also teaching the seminar on war crimes trials in the 20th century.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so the Weimar Republic is part of your book, too.
Yes.
It plays a big role in the beginning part of the book. So before we get into the book proper, what drew you to write about Protestant churches and sort of reinventing themselves in 20th century Germany?
Yeah, so I'll back up a little bit toward kind of my own biography, how I got into the field. So I lived in Germany for the first time in 2011-12. I was an English teaching assistant in a public school in Berlin through the Fulbright program. And when I was there, I got interested in a lot of the kind of religious dynamics and tensions I was seeing. It was quite a diverse school. One could perceive a certain amount of tension over the sort of public display of Islamic symbols. You know, one would hear a certain degree of skepticism sometimes from teachers about students observing Ramadan, for instance. At the same time, Christian religious education was still offered, granted as an optional subject, but still as a subject in public schools, which is something that I was totally unfamiliar with from the United States context. And at the same time, I had another position actually working for a Jewish organization in Berlin. So also got exposed to interesting religious dynamics. I remember at one point I attended a so-called German Israel Day and was quite struck by the number of sort of Catholic nuns and other kind of visibly Christian attendees, which is something that I'm sure you're familiar with from your work on Christian Zionism. And all of this kind of led me to question this sort of common narrative that we have about European societies basically being kind of secular versus this kind of anomaly of the United States, which is a sort of Western democracy where religion supposedly plays this larger role. And that didn't quite fit with what I was seeing. And then when I got to graduate school, I worked with the intellectual historian Peter Gordon, who was very interested in theories of secularization. And I became exposed to a more academic literature about secularism that questioned this kind of narrative of religious decline, that was thinking about how religious organizations could still play an important political role, even though, let's say, fewer Europeans are attending church regularly, a kind of classical measure of secularization. So, so some of those contradictions I was interested in puzzling through. And I think the Protestant churches interested me especially because there was just a gap in the literature. The Catholic churches, I'm sure we'll come to, has this particular role in the post-war moment because it plays a major role in sort of supporting Christian democratic parties that come to power in West Germany, but in other places in Western Europe. Protestants were often sort of left out of that story in terms of the place of religion in the post-war reconstruction of Europe. But I found quite a bit of evidence in my early research that Protestants had equally been participating in all of those debates about sort of reconstructing society after Nazism, but had a quite different religious heritage and legacy that was being brought to bear that I wanted to explore in my research. So I would say there was both a kind of personal experience and then sort of academic influences.
Yeah, that's often
well.
How it goes, right? There's some type of real life experience that leads to some pretty deep questions that require research. So I think for maybe it might be a surprise for listeners to hear that there's a gap in the literature about Protestants and Germany, in part because that's the homeland of Martin Luther, and is often associated as at least historically a lot of Protestant activity. So Maybe that's an opportunity to just talk about, what's the religious scene in Germany? What's the breakdown between Protestants and Catholics? Are there other groups in Germany sort of at the beginning of your story? Maybe we say 1920s, 1930s. What does it look like in Germany on the religious front?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, early 20th century, through the 1920s, Protestants make up about 2/3 of the German population, Catholics about 1/3, and then there's a small Jewish minority, less than 1%. And within the Protestant churches, the structure of organized religion is quite different from the kind of very multi-denominational system that we see in the U.S. There are certainly evangelizing kind of Anglo-American denominations, Methodists, Baptists, Mormons, whether one considers them Protestant, that are in Germany at the time. But overwhelmingly, the Protestant scene is dominated by sort of large regional churches into which people essentially become members, at baptism, sort of through family lines, but that have a kind of close relationship to the state. This is actually a legacy of the Reformation, when local princes throughout the German state would sort of determine the confession of their lands. And you still have these kind of state-sponsored churches in the early 20th century that, for instance, collect their revenues through the state tax rolls, that have the privilege of performing public functions like supervising religious education in the schools, which one still sees today. So these legacies. And Protestants were not only the larger confession, but also the more socially dominant one. In the monarchy that ruled Germany up until 1918 was Protestant. And because of this system of state church intertwinement, the Kaiser, the sort of leader of the German Empire, was actually also officially the head of the Protestant Church of Prussia. So quite different from the system of what the Germans would call kind of free churches that dominate in the United States. This is broken, though, this sort of link in 1918. I mentioned already I'm teaching a course on the Weimar Republic. So in 1918, the king abdicates. There's a kind of revolution that erupts as the military effort is collapsing at the end of the Great War, leading to the declaration of essentially a secular republic that does not have an official church, which becomes a major shock for the pastorate and the church-going laity.
So one other aspect of this is, I think, much different than an American context is, and maybe this is, tell me if this is not the right way to say it, but you basically, as a German citizen, almost have to opt out of being considered Christian or religious, at least. Whereas in our society here in the United States, it's often more of a voluntaristic opting in. There's not a default, when you're born, you're not registered sort of with a state-sponsored church in the U.S. But that is a situation in Germany at this time. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So the opt-out situation is really critical, and I think also gets at some of these kind of paradoxes of secularism. Because certainly, especially in urban Germany, among kind of the industrial working classes, Germany is the sort of most industrialized state in Europe by the end of the 19th century. You're seeing declining levels of religious participation among workers who are gravitating toward the large socialist movement, yet relatively few of them actually formally leave the church. People are still being baptized in the church. The church is still playing a role in funeral rites, for instance. So you still have a church that's able to collect revenues from millions of sort of nominal members and thereby have and maintain these connections to the state and play an active political role, even as the number of members who are regularly attending services and sort of actively engaged in Christian institutions, especially on the Protestant side, less so on the Catholic, is declining already by the early 20th century. And this is kind of so the challenge of how to then sort of maintain their public role, you know, whether the churches still deserve to have this kind of special public status is a matter of contention already, especially, I would say, during the 1920s.
Right. Okay, so in your book, you track what you call a generation of church leaders, writers, intellectuals who are, you know, so born in the late 19th century and so are coming of age, you could say, in the 1920s and 30s. So just tell us about sort of who that group is and how they experienced the Weimar years up until 1933 and the rise of Nazism. Just give us a sense of sort of who are the people we're tracking through this story.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the reason that I chose sort of this group is because when you look at, so the book is really trying to explain, I would say, ultimately, the kind of embrace of more democratic ideals and kind of human rights ideas after 1945. But when you look at the church leaders, you know, major intellectuals, people shaping those movements after 1945, you see that many of them were born sort of around the turn of the 20th century. And as you mentioned, sort of are beginning their careers or attending seminary during the 1920s. And what's really, I think, critical for this generation is that kind of rupture between church and state that happens after 1918. So in the German Revolution, there's briefly a kind of a socialist party that takes over the Prussian culture ministry, threatens to strip away all of the church's public privileges, including the supervision of religious education. That doesn't happen, but to some extent, it creates this deep degree of suspicion between the Weimar Republic and the churches. And for young sort of Christians coming of age in this period, they're confronted with this question of sort of how is Protestant identity going to be redefined now in this secular republic? Many would gravitate toward a kind of Christian youth movement that was quite nationalistic, that was skeptical of democracy in particular due to the ways that democracy was associated with Germany's defeat in the First World War. This was, of course, quite a common sentiment on the German right after World War I, but in the Protestant youth movement, it gets infused more with Christian ideas, the idea that the Republic is somehow a disruption of divine order. There's also sort of longstanding ideas about the German people having a kind of special relationship to God and the divine, which sort of come more out of 19th century Protestant nationalism, but are also being kind of reconfigured in this turbulent moment in the 1920s.
Okay, so you can see that this type of response to Weimar means that there's going to be a complicated relationship with Nazism when it emerges, or when it comes to power, I guess, in 1933. So give us an overview sense. How does the Protestant church respond to Nazism?
Yeah. So in 1933, this is, of course, a deeply contentious question. I would first say, and there's been, many decades of historiography, kind of scholarly literature, but also kind of public polemical debates on this question. What I think has been pretty well established is that in 1933, there's a quite high degree of enthusiasm, even from famous pastors like Martin Niemöller, for instance, Otto Debelius, who was somewhat less well-known, but both of whom become active in the so-called Confessing Church during the Nazi period in 1933, are quite enthusiastic. The Nazi Party is often seen as a kind of vehicle of religious revival, especially because the Republic is associated with secularism, with the disestablishment of religion, And there's a hope that, you know, Hitler is somehow a figure who's been, you know, sent by God to kind of revive the German nation. The Nazis themselves talk about this idea of a positive Christianity, which is a vision of a kind of Christianity that overcomes the confessional divide. And this is actually appealing to many Protestant nationalists, right? Because they want to define Protestantism not simply as a kind of particularistic confession or set of dogmas, but rather a kind of spirit that's going to guide the German nation as a whole. So this idea of the Nazis as promoting a certain kind of big tent Christianity was quite appealing. Now, ultimately, things come to a head when the Nazis start to trample on how the baptism is defined, on the privileges of the churches. So the Nazis want to essentially define the definition of a Christian in kind of racialized terms. Mm-hmm. There was quite a bit of sort of intermarriage between the Jewish and Christian communities at this time, a long history going back to the 18th century of Jewish conversion, especially into the Protestant churches. But for the Nazis, anybody who was a baptized Christian but had a Jewish family background was not really Christian, could not be a church member. This, mm-hmm. of course, conflicts with, you know, ideas of the baptism. So there's a big divide pretty early on between a Christian faction, the so-called German Christians, that wants a fully kind of racial Aryan church, you know, eliminate the Old Testament, deny right. that Jesus was a Jew, versus conservative pastors that are still quite politically sympathetic to Nazism. But and especially its idea of sort of recovering German glory after the war, but who reject this incursion on traditional Christian ideas of the baptism, as well as the Nazis' incursions on religious education and other things. There is a more radical faction we can talk about that actually does want to call out the Nazi attacks on the Jewish community. But that's a smaller group, I would say, than had what was presented in kind of later portrayals of this period.
Right. Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because mm-hmm. I think for many of our listeners, that smaller faction is the one that gets a mm-hmm. lot of sort of attention. Mm-hmm. That'd be the Confessing Church. That's Karl Barth, mm-hmm. the famous theologian. And it's mm-hmm. and that's someone like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, mm-hmm. who certainly in American Christian culture, there's a lot of literature around yes. Bonhoeffer. So I think, you know, Bonhoeffer, for many Americans, sort of the stand-in mm-hmm. of the right way that mm-hmm. the German should have reacted, or he represents the right way that some Germans did react to Nazism. I guess that there's two questions. How representative was Bonhoeffer mm-hmm. for a broader movement? And are we remembering Bonhoeffer the right way when we think of him as someone who, you know, very clearly and very consistently sort of did everything he could to stand up against Nazism?
Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think that's a great question, right? Bonhoeffer, who was a Lutheran theologian who had ties to a knowledge of the German resistance against Hitler, was imprisoned in the winter of 1943 and ultimately executed in April of 1945, just weeks before German defeat on Hitler's personal orders for his ties to the resistance organization. So I think the idea, you know, he's certainly an important figure in the fact that he's become a kind of, you know, seen as a kind of moral guide for how Christians should respond to situations of authoritarianism and dictatorship, I think, is quite understandable. At the same time, he's very much not representative. So he's one of the few figures to call out not only Nazi attacks on Christians of Jewish ascent, but Nazi attacks on the Jewish community as well. Mm. But this is a step that very few other figures, even within the Confessing Church, within this more radical faction that rejects the Nazi incursion onto the churches, are willing to take. So, for instance, in the aftermath of the Kristallnacht pogrom in 1938, which was an organized attack on Jewish synagogues and businesses, as well as Jewish people, 30,000 Jewish men are sent to concentration camps in the aftermath. Scholars that have looked into this have found examples of only three Confessing Church pastors who actually publicly called out the Kristallnacht in their sermons. One of them was a lesser known figure named Helmut Gollwitz, or somewhat better known in Germany itself, a close colleague of Bonhoeffer. I mean, even if one looks at the sermon that he delivered at that moment, right, the language is there, but it's also quite veiled. So he criticizes, you know, Christians who place their loyalty to the state above Christian conscience, let's say, right? But he doesn't actually sort of directly call out the crime. So Bonhoeffer himself was a fairly marginal figure within the Confessing Church, and really, I think, despaired in some of his private letters to his close colleagues, if one goes back to read them, that there wasn't a kind of larger witnessing. You also asked whether he's been remembered correctly. I don't know if he wanted to come to this, but there was a film that aired recently last November about Bonhoeffer, where he's portrayed as this real kind of militant character, you know, holding a gun, directly involved in kind of secret plans to flaunt the resistance. And I think Bonhoeffer, you know, the real Bonhoeffer had a much more kind of ambivalent attitude toward this question of whether violence is ever justified, even in response to a tyrannical regime. He ultimately comes to the conclusion around 1942, 1943, that actually there isn't, you know, Ten Commandments, there's actually not a Christian justification even for the murder of the tyrant, but he feels compelled by his conscience to take that action anyway, and therefore needs to simply beg, you know, fall on God's grace and forgiveness and beg for mercy because of this impossible dilemma. So he's very much a figure who sort of agonizes over the kind of difficulties of Christian life during the Nazi period. And I think for that reason, you know, he's remembered as a figure who took a kind of very clear-cut position, who was broadly representative. But if one goes back, I think the historical reality is more complex and also somewhat more interesting.
Yeah, and it's one of the, you know, a great example of sort of the difference between memory, or what historians sometimes call memory, and, you know, a critical historical account of someone. And
and the memory also becomes part of the history, though, I think of how the church has developed after the
war. That's right. Okay, so maybe putting Bonhoeffer to the side for a minute, just to focus on the main part of the story. Mm-hmm. So as we go through the period of the Nazi rule of World War II, you know, what's the broader conclusion about how we should think about the Protestant church? These two factions you talked about, the sort of the German Christian church and then the conservative Protestants who have some hangups, but are also in some way, you know, working with the regime and other things. Maybe you can speak for yourself, maybe for the broader scholarship, but are they broadly collaborative with Nazism? Are they victims in some sense? Are there actual phases to that story where they're more collaborative at the front end and more resistant at the latter end? How would you summarize that 12-year period?
Yeah, sure. I would say that those clear-cut categories are sometimes difficult because in some ways one can be a participant and a witness and a victim all at the same time. I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to deny that there are confessing church pastors, hundreds of them, who were being harassed by the Gestapo, the Nazi secret police, due to making public statements about, for instance, the Nazis trampling on Christian religious education. There are pastors who were arrested. There are pastors who face bans on public speaking. Martin Niemöller being sent to Sachsenhausen and Dachau for 8 years due to publicly criticizing the regime is quite an unusual case. Again, another figure I think taken is representative who wasn't necessarily so. But there was certainly victimization and then at the same time participation as well. So there are a number of pastors within the Confessing Church, for instance, who join the Wehrmacht military chaplaincy, so who become witnesses to Nazi crimes as members of the chaplaincy on the Eastern Front, and to some extent also trying to provide some kind of Christian justification for the church's role. This is something that my senior colleague Doris Bergen has recently written about very brilliantly, where you will have pastors on the Eastern Front who talk about the kind of Nazi rescue of the German rescue of Christianity through the occupation of the Soviet Union, where Christianity had been destroyed. And some of those military chaplains were pastors who themselves may have been harassed by the Gestapo or harassed by the regime, but also see Christianity, you know, even if they don't identify as kind of Nazi ideologues, still see themselves as kind of representatives of Christianity's role in creating some kind of new order. What happens, I think, after the war, and to some extent even during the war itself, in part due to how the Confessing Church is being portrayed in the international media, for instance, is that the more obvious accounts of resistance, such as the imprisonment of Martin Niemöller, who appears in the cover of Time magazine in 1940, are being exemplified and really highlighted. The role of confessing church pastors as military chaplains is something that's come through in the historiography only in the past several years.
Right. And on that point, too, talk to us about, I think, the leading pastors are often, you know, sort of the faces of German Protestantism at this point. In your book, you talk a lot about the role that non-pastors, women, lay people played. How should we think about that? What was the sort of look of the broader activity and who was involved in it?
Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, if one is looking at the more kind of radical faction within the Confessing Church resistance, so people who were not only talking about church privileges and religious education and baptized Christians of Jewish descent, but who were actually engaging in rescue efforts on behalf of Jews threatened with persecution. What one finds is that these are people who are kind of outsiders to the official church structures and church leadership, right? Which makes sense because even people like, Martin Niemöller, Otto Debelius, who are pastors and kind of leaders within the Confessing Church, right? What they're trying to do in part is to sort of protect the institutional interests of the church from the incursions of the Nazi state. Mm-hmm. On the ground, one sees, for instance, Niemöller's parish of Berlin becomes a real center of resistance, though one where Niemöller himself maintains some kind of distance. But there are a number of lay women in that parish, some of whom have become somewhat better known recently, Elizabeth Schmitz, who was a Berlin school teacher, who pens a memorandum calling out the Nuremberg laws. Helene Jacobs and Gertrude Steven, lay women who were participating in a circle that's falsifying passports for Jews trying to escape. So one finds these smaller circles in particular of lay women, often who are single, who are sometimes religious educators who are participating in those more active resistance efforts. And a number of Christians of Jewish descent as well who are members of these parishes, unsurprisingly, because they oftentimes will have, Jewish family, are also more involved in active resistance efforts. So at the local level, there are efforts to, create false documents for Jews trying to escape, to hide Jews in, apartments of parishioners to help them evade deportation. But again, it's not primarily the sort of leading pastors that are involved. And in part, it's, because also many of the pastors themselves are conscripted into the military by the time the war begins.
Right.
The podcast notes for today's conversation include a link to view this episode on YouTube. Remember to follow or subscribe to stay updated with our latest episodes in your podcast app.
Before we go to the post-war period, it just struck me that some people might not know, or they might not associate Niemöller with the thing that he's most, at least famous for in like pop culture here, which is a certain prayer he gave, which I'm not going to be able to recite right now, but is roughly, do you have any memory of the prayer?
It begins, first they came for the communists, but I was not a communist. Then they came for the social Democrats. Then they came for the Jews, but I was not Jewish. And then they came for me, but there was no one.
There was no one left to stand.
I mean, this is, there's different versions and different translations, but that's the gist of it.
Okay,
I learned when I was 12 years old and first studied the Holocaust in Hebrew school, right? So it's also gotten kind of taken up in the Jewish discourse on the Holocaust as well.
That's interesting. I just saw it on a social media post like 2 days ago, referencing current events. So so still a very prominent sort of pop culture touch point. Okay, so going to the post-war period, which I think is really where we see the fruits of your labor in terms of the way you're looking at the church. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just walk us through how does the church respond to the early post-war period, and how's it grappling with this history that it's just gone through, the 12-year period, and trying to sort of make a case for why the church still matters in post-1945 Germany.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So there's this, several phenomenon going on simultaneously. So on the one hand, you see definitely the deep legacies of, the kind of fractiousness and division that I mentioned during the Nazi period. People like Niemöller, Gollwitzer, and other, confessing church pastors who had experienced the repression of the state are very upset with the more kind of conservative pastors who had passed through the period more unscathed, who hadn't defended them and now sort of occupy leading positions in the churches. So on the one hand, these kind of personal animosity stemming from those deep differences of the experience of Nazism are still there. But on the other hand, there's a broad demand across the different factions within the post-war church that the church should really play a central, a pivotal role in kind of sort of moral reconstruction of Germany after Nazism. And this is something one sees not only in Germany, but among sort of Christian communities in other European countries as well. I think what's, of course, distinct about Germany after the war is that it's no longer a sovereign state, right? Germany famously gets carved up by the Allies. So you have three zones ruled by the Western allies, American, British, and French, and then the Soviet zone in the east. So Germany is no longer a sovereign state. There isn't a kind of government authority. And what this in part means is that the churches can sort of come in and fill the gap, right? The churches have they still have the ability to organize welfare, food aid, a housing construction program. So a lot of because of the institutional structures of the churches sort of still exist after the war, a lot of aid is kind of being funneled through them. And then the German churches develop sort of important political contacts with the Allied occupation regimes as well. Of course, the Soviets are very skeptical of this idea that the churches should play a role as the kind of moral conscience of a post-Nazi Germany, right? The Soviets basically interpret the churches, not entirely wrongly, I would say, as sort of part of the sort of bourgeois reactionary bloc that helped bring the Nazis to power. Not true of all Protestants, but certainly many had been enthusiastic. The French, coming out of their own sort of tradition of state secularism, also quite skeptical. But on the British and American side, there are a number of occupation officials. There are religious affairs specialists who were British and American pastors, some of whom had had contacts with confessing church pastors during the war, at least sort of had read about the confessing church, and think about the confessing church as being sort of exemplified by people like Niemöller and Bonhoeffer and sort of a center of anti-Nazi resistance, and therefore think that the church sort of does have this special role to play in the post-war period. And so it's through that the churches managed to kind of carve out, you know, new privileges in the post-war constitution, while at the same time also playing a role in sort of galvanizing opposition against Allied denazification measures, which perhaps is something we can
we can talk about that. Just a comment on, it's interesting to me you say the British and the American occupiers are the ones who are sort of most interested in viewing the German Protestants as a sort of force for their side for what they want to do. That seems to line up perfectly with how Americans are interpreting the war themselves as a moral, even religious war. And then, of course, we're moving into the early Cold War period. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. isn't totally unique, but is certainly the exemplar of interpreting the Cold War as a sort of religious conflict between a God-filled free world and an atheistic Soviet world. So it makes sense to me that as they're thinking about whatever they want to, you know, reconstitute in West Germany, that they see the church as just inherently, because of the way they think the world works, as a force for good, as a force that will sort of inhabit the values they want to inhabit, as opposed to something that's going to undermine what they're trying to do.
Right. And a number of, major figures in the occupation and sort of post-war American politics more broadly have close connections to the international Protestant groups. I'm thinking most obviously John Foster Dulles, who will become the Secretary of State under Eisenhower, was a member of the Federal Council of Churches, sort of major Protestant organization of the U.S., part of this group called a Commission on a Just and Durable Peace, which envisions, you know, Christian churches as really kind of essential to articulating, you know, visions of what the West will be after the war. Dulles's brother, Alan Dulles, who's more well known as the director of the CIA, actually writes a book in 1947 about the German resistance against Nazism, where he highlights this idea of a kind of Christian anti-Nazi resistance. So there's certainly a dialogue between, this is one of the things I also sort of discuss in the book, the resistance narrative is not simply being sort of invented whole cloth by the, you know, German church figures, but sort of in dialogue between Germans and then sort of Anglo-American, to some extent Dutch colleagues who have connections to these international Christian organizations.
Right. Okay. So then so let's talk a bit about the denazification. Mm-hmm. This actually complicates it because at the same time that many in Germany, also in America and elsewhere, are seeing the church as sort of the polar opposite of Nazism. Mm-hmm. The church is also involved in sort of resisting denazification in Germany as well. So take us through sort of what the church is thinking at that moment.
Yeah. So denazification is a quite complicated and contentious phenomenon. So I'll first sort of introduce sort of what we mean by this term. So the Nuremberg International Military Tribunal, which brings up 21 high-ranking Nazis on charges of war crimes, crimes against humanity, crimes against peace, is by far the most famous example of Allied attempts to sort of remove Nazi ideology from German society. But especially early on, the Allies are envisioning very much a kind of transformative occupation where Nazi ideology has to be rooted out altogether. So there are hundreds of trials across the four occupation zones of Nazi military leaders, but also civilian politicians and other business people, professionals who had been complicit. But there's an even larger program, which is called denazification, where millions of Germans seeking jobs in the post-war civil service or other professions have to fill out a questionnaire reporting on their political activities during the Nazi period. Mm. Anyone who had been a party member could get brought before a tribunal to evaluate their degree of complicity and whether they could remain part of public life. So this was part of the vision of denazification that was articulated by the all four allies in 1945. But it becomes deeply controversial. And for the Protestant churches, essentially the argument that gets made is that because the war is a product of a kind of secularization, right? Europe's fall away from God. So it's seen through very much, you know, rather than sort of Nazism as this specific German phenomenon, Nazism is kind of universalized to represent Europe's fall away from God. Again, a convenient narrative that allied some of the church's own complicity in Nazism, right? But because of that, ultimately, a post-Nazi vision has to be sort of born out of Christian ideas of grace and reconciliation on all sides. So the churches would point out that the Allies had also committed war crimes, the bombings of German civilian infrastructure and cities, the expulsions of millions of ethnic Germans from East Central Europe at the end of the war. Of course, these things are not on the docket at Nuremberg. They're not part of denazification. So there's claims around a kind of victor's justice. But for the churches, these also become coded in an anti-Semitic way, right? This sort of putative contrast between sort of Christian grace versus a kind of punitive Jewish justice and leaders of the, you know, this sort of campaign against denazification in which Niemöller is involved. Bishop Theophil Worm, who was the official head of the post-war church federation, also involved. They don't shy away sometimes from pointing out that some of the Allied prosecutors at Nuremberg, for instance, were Germans of Jewish descent who had gone into exile and then came back as part of the Allied forces. So we see these sort of continuities in anti-Semitism and old school Protestant nationalism. But at the same time, the final thing I'll say here is that, in fact, denazification is quite controversial in the United States as well. You have especially, you know, Republican senators or senators who represent states like Wisconsin that have right. large German-speaking populations that think that the way that Germany is being treated is sort of too punitive and that also sort of favor this vision of a kind of reconciliation that leaves the past behind, especially as the Cold War is on the horizon. You need West Germany as a kind of military ally. That's coming to the fore as well. So, in fact, the church's resistance against denazification, it seems kind of paradoxical for us. But from their perspective, this was an extension of their kind of resistance against National Socialism, their extension of their resistance against a kind of overbearing state that tramples on Christian values. So that was consistent from their worldview and also for many of their American supporters and interlocutors as well.
Yeah. And one of the fascinating things to me was seeing how the critics of denazification were actually invoking concepts like human rights mm-hmm. on their side. Mm-hmm. I mean, often in the American yes. context, it's the Americans who are using human rights language to prosecute mm-hmm. The Nazis. But yeah, explain that. Like, how is human rights language sort of entering in through this debate over denazification and other things happening at this time?
Yeah, the theological argument that's sort of being put forth, right, is that human rights aren't simply, you know, natural rights or a kind of expression of human rationality or sort of sovereignty over oneself, a kind of classical Enlightenment notion of human rights, mm-hmm. But rather human rights for especially sort of post-war Protestants steeped in a kind of Lutheran tradition can only be gifts of God's grace. I think this especially sort of emphasis on grace and this emphasis on sort of human fallenness and sort of innate sinfulness, which is, of course, a theme that's especially coming up in the aftermath of the war, is one reason why human rights, you know, previously had not been a kind of language that would have been used by Protestants, whether in Germany, whether steeped in a Lutheran or Reformed tradition. But after the war, you know, human rights begins to take on this sort of universal qualities, a sort of language of post-war international Christian reconstruction. So I mentioned, John Foster Dulles and the Federal mm-hmm. Council of Churches, which is also advancing a vision of human rights as a kind of basis for a post-war Christian reconstruction of Europe and sort of guarding human dignity now against the depredations of communism, right? So even though human rights sort of fit somewhat askew with their sort of vision of this kind of fallen humanity that must sort of fall upon God's mercy. Nonetheless, Protestants who want to kind of integrate themselves into this international discourse of post-war reconstruction and who want to sort of gain political clout in post-war Germany start to develop a sort of theological view of human rights, but one that's very much sort of oriented toward their side, where rights are conferred by God's grace and therefore can only really be interpreted by the church and sort of interpreted not as, you know, universal and always having the same meaning, but rather sort of is what, you know, the path God is showing us in the present moment. And so it's through these sets of ideas that ultimately, the discourse of human rights is being used, for instance, to talk about, you know, opposition to a certain kind of victor's justice or the need for sort of grace and reconciliation as a basis for the post-war. What's interesting, though, is that then many of those same pastors who were involved in these campaigns against denazification continue to go on to frame their church as a source of sort of human rights against a kind of overweening state in various kinds of post-war debates around military service and sort of state power in the West German context, right? So that language extends beyond the immediate post-war campaign against denazification.
Yeah. So, yeah, just to sketch out sort of where you take the story, it seems like, just using my words here, it seems like one of the major arguments that the churches are making is that they are the conscience of West Germany for, you know, through the 50s and 60s. And so a number of different, you know, sort of controversial issues or debates over how far the federal government, or I guess I'm using, I don't know if they would call it the federal government, but how far the state government should sort of, what they should require from citizens and so forth, that the church sees itself as that someone that needs to weigh in on those things and actually is the source of the wisdom for how those things should be talked about. So whether that is conscientious objection, you know, from the military, whether it is, you know, debates about nuclear policy or other things, it seems like that's sort of the legacy of this history, is that the Protestant church sort of puts himself in there, and to an extent the society accepts that, or there's a role for the for the church to play. What would you modify to my summary there of that last sort of long period, you know, 20 years or 30 years that you cover in the book?
I mean, I think that's great. I think that sort of category of conscience becomes really central, I think, in part because it allows this sort of generation of Protestant pastors and intellectuals who I write about to sort of retain a kind of particular confessional identity after the war. There is a Christian Democratic Party which claims to represent a certain Christian ecumenism encompassing both Catholics and Protestants. Some Protestants join the Christian Democratic Party. Some are skeptical because of they see that the sort of Christian Democratic Party very much sort of aligns with the Cold War, and they're concerned about sort of alienating the Protestant population in East Germany. But for all of these Protestants, the idea of conscience is something that they can at least claim sort of distinguishes them from the Catholic Church. Now, of course, this is not really true, and I'll cite my colleague Peter Kaika's book on, it's called Follow Your Conscience, which some of you, I'm not
we've sure actually interviewed
you've
him
had him
on that book.
So that's great. So I would refer listeners to that as well. And, you know, he really shows how actually a discourse of conscience got mobilized, and for him in the U.S. context in the post-war decades. But for kind of Protestants looking to sort of stake out a confessional identity, looking to kind of rehabilitate their churches after this very complex legacy of intertwinement with the National Socialist State, one of the claims that can get made is that basically Catholicism is, and this is, you know, classic kind of Protestant nationalist critique of Catholicism in Germany, right, going back to the 19th century, that Catholicism is a sort of religion about obedience to kind of, church authorities, which is, of course, rooted in the Vatican. You have Protestants like Niemöller and others who sort of criticize the West German state, which supports a kind of Western European remilitarization, as being sort of in league with the Vatican to kind of repress Protestant Germany. On the other hand, the Protestant is sort of distinguished by their ability to kind of make independent moral judgments and follow their conscience, something exemplified supposedly by people like Bonhoeffer.
Right.
The Protestant resistance under Nazism. So this set of arguments then leads the Protestant church to become really central, for instance, in advocating for a right of conscientious objection to military service, with an argument basically that a sort of Protestant conscience, which is sort of authorized to make free decisions and is not controlled by the state, that in light of this legacy of resistance against Nazism, that vision of conscience should be actually come foundational for West German democracy in general, and therefore be encoded to law through offering citizens the right to choose not to participate in military service. And in fact, West Germany is the only, I believe, democratic constitution in 1949 in the world that enshrines a right of conscientious objection quite narrowly, but that right is expanded in the course of the 50s and 60s in part through Protestant lobbying, as I show. And even for more conservative Protestants who support West German remilitarization, there's still a degree of support for this idea of conscientious objection, the idea that we still need to sort of give credence to this legacy that conscience sort of has for us as Protestants and that played in the war. Again, this is a very much a kind of biased account, I think, one that's not at all fair to sort of long traditions of kind of Catholic theology and how Catholics are engaging with similar questions. But this confessional language is one of the ways I think that the church ultimately finds its way to espousing a kind of democratic vision in a way that would be quite surprising if one looks at the sort of earlier socialization of some of these individuals, as I talked about before.
Yeah, and it's just such a fascinating history, too, just comparing it to the U.S. example, where when we talk about conscientious objection, or we often talk about like the peace churches, the Anabaptists, the very free churches as the source of that type of theology. And it's just so fascinating to see in other contexts like that same impulse comes from a very different motivation and set of theological doctrines and so forth in a different time. So, yeah, it's very important, I guess, you know, a lesson for all of us. Very important to sort of understand the context within which these topics come up, the national context, the theological context. Because it goes a long way to explaining sort of why certain ideas like conscientious objection sort of become salient at certain moments and not at others, and in certain parts of Christian tradition and not in others. Okay, one last question, sort of pulling back and thinking about most of the listeners are going to be Americans and might have a pretty American understanding of even what secularization is. I was even thinking as you were talking about just the differences in early part of our conversation around sort of modern Germany and how we think about secularism. Like so many of the markers we use in polling to measure secularism or secularization in the U.S. are very, I guess you could say, like American Protestant based. They're about like how often do you pray? How often do you go to church? These things that are very much about the practices you're doing that would signal whether you're being secular or not. And in other contexts, those aren't the defining marks of whether or not you're religious or secular. So accepting the way that we often talk about in the U.S., how do you think about when you're teaching students at UW, when you're talking to people who don't have a strong familiarity with the German context, what are the things Americans should keep in mind when either engaging German history, maybe we talked a bit about Bonhoeffer and others, around topics related to what you're talking about, or when they come across the idea of secularism or secularization. What does the German example help us fill in our blind spots, so to speak, from the American perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it can help us see is that secularization can have multiple different meanings and be on multiple different trajectories at the same time. So I certainly wouldn't deny, right, that secularization absolutely is happening along the kind of lines that you discussed in terms of a degree of private faith or church membership knowledge of Christian doctrine, you know, especially within German Protestantism, going all the way back to the early 20th century. But at the same time, for some of the reasons we've discussed, right, the churches continue to play important public roles. Their status is so-called corporations of public law is enshrined in the German Constitution in 1949. So they still have this legal status where they can collect revenues through the state tax system, as well as supervise religious education in schools, as I mentioned. But I think the kind of secularization that one sees in the German context, and perhaps maybe in some American examples as well, though less so, is that the Protestant churches themselves are coming, as they come to identify themselves with democratic values, there's a sort of self-secularization that's happening, right? Where, you know, publicly the churches, you know, church leaders will say, you know, we're not here to kind of, you know, evangelize or sort of, from, you know, say that everyone should be a Protestant or sort of promote a certain kind of Christian dogma. Like, obviously, that can't be the church's role in a society where fewer and fewer people are believing Christians, but rather to kind of represent a sort of conscience of the nation, to represent, you know, certain kinds of democratic values and to show that actually, you know, the values that sort of guide the German state, the German constitution, you know, weren't simply kind of created out of whole cloth, but have this deeper source. So there's a kind of, I think, secularization in terms of how the churches are talking about themselves, which is a bit different from the idea of secularism in terms of the decline of conventional of religious worship. And one sees still these kinds of connections between the churches and political leaders for that reason. You know, the presidency in Germany, so this is not the head of, you know, they make a distinction between the head of government, the chancellor, who kind of runs the parliament, versus the head of state, who's supposed to kind of speak to the broadly shared values and bring people together across political parties. And the head of state historically has frequently been a Protestant, including the current president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier. Often they've been connected with the Kirchentag, which is a biennial so-called lay assembly that continues to draw upwards of 100,000 people to these mass conventions, despite Germany being increasingly a secular society. The church still holds this space open where people are coming together to talk about, you know, migration and climate change, ecological issues and sort of major issues that face citizens in common. And frequently Germany's presidents have been people who had connections with that body, right? So I think that's a different kind of secularism than simply kind of the, you know, elimination of religion as an important factor in people's private lives.
Right. Yeah. And that's fascinating. And I think what you said at the beginning of your answer about secularism can sort of be going on multiple tracks at the same time is a good thing to keep in mind when thinking about the American context, but then other tracks that are not available in our society, but are in places in Europe and elsewhere. Brandon, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure to talk to you about your book. The title again is Reinventing Protestant Germany, Religious Nationalists and the Contest for Post-Nazi Democracy. If you're interested in more episodes, head to slbf.org. Check out our studio page. We have now more than 150 conversations there for the Upwards podcast. So thanks for tuning in. See you again next time.
Thank you for tuning into the Upwards podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. For more information about the S.L. Brown Foundation and Upper House, please visit slbf.org. Go in peace to be a light on our campuses, in our churches, and in our businesses so that all may flourish.